And now it's time for the Earth First Update. All the environmental news you can use. I'm Uncle Dennis here in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. Want to make sure that you get a pencil and paper handy, because you just never know when there's something that comes up that you want to write down and take, remember later, and your brain don't work so good like mine. And you want to know that webpage, maybe that email address, maybe that time, date, location. Well, speaking of time, date, and location, here's something to have your pencil ready for. The Mountain Justice Spring Break is coming up March 7th through 14th. That's screaming up on us here. It's going to take place in Southwest Virginia. The fifth year in a row, the Renew Collective and SAMS will be hosting Mountain Justice Spring Break March 7th through 14th in Southwest Virginia. As a participant, you'll engage in the environment, health, economic, and social impacts that decades of coal mining as a monoeconomy has had on the Appalachian communities, and learning about organizing and resistance efforts. Beyond mountaintop removal, you'll learn about a broad range of environmental and social justice issues in Central Appalachia and the exciting work being done by community groups to transition the economy and build resilience. Our days will consist of workshops, service field trips, and opportunities to network with other activists, and our evenings will wind down with citizen and local organizer panels, music, and campfires with story sharing. Over the course of the event, you'll meet and support folks working to build a better future for Appalachia, build your own skills as organizers and change agents, and along the way have fun. Go hiking and put in a little elbow grease for local service projects. Once again, Mountain Justice Spring Break 2015. Take place March 7th through the 14th, where? Southwest Virginia. Where to get more information? Go to the Earth First Newswire. And a Wisconsin eco-activist named Crow has been sentenced to 9 months for a 2013 mining disruption. In this story from Malcontents, I guess, as found on the Earth First Newswire, Katie Crowcloth was sentenced to serve 9 months in Iron County Jail before a packed courtroom in Hurley, Wisconsin, and was described by the presiding judge as committing an offense on the low level of the spectrum in a political protest in 2013. Two sentences, one of 6 and the other of 3 months, were ordered to be served consecutively by Ms. Cloth, who is eligible for work release and has 2 weeks to report to jail. Cloth will have 5 years of probation with the felony charge and 2 years with the misdemeanor, noted the Ashland Daily Press. The presiding judge, Price County Judge Douglas T. Fox, said a prison sentence was not appropriate and withheld requested prison sentences, rejecting Iron County D.A. Michael Lipsky's appeals. Lipsky is notoriously corrupt and known for fronting for Gobic Taconite, or GTAC. GTAC's $80,000 request for restitution was rejected in full. Ms. Cloth, a 27-year-old woman who had no criminal prior record, is an environmental and Native American activist who faced 4 criminal charges for actions in a 2013 political protest at the proposed GTAC 9 site in northern Wisconsin. Ms. Cloth had pleaded no contest to the 2 charges last September. Cloth's attorney, John C. Bachman of Eau Claire, Wisconsin, said he had never seen so many letters of support in a criminal case today as at this hearing. Katie is an intelligent and skilled botanist who has much to teach about the natural world, said environmental activist Rob Ganson of Citizens Concerned About the Proposed Pinoki Mine in a letter to Judge Fox. Crow was described as, quote, looking well yesterday by a longtime resident of Ashland County who spoke with Crow at the produce aisle of the Chacamegan Food Co-op on Tuesday, January 20th in the city of Ashland. The same source said Crow told him she has a good feeling about tomorrow's trial and claims to be ready for whatever happens. Today at the sentencing hearing, Crow was described as, quote, emotional but composed and remorseful, said an attendee of the hearing. Said Crow in July of 2014, those who fight against the destruction of the water, land, plants, and human and non-human animals of the Pinoki Hills and Bad River watershed are not terrorists. The only terrorists are those who plot to blow up the hills with ammonium nitrate and use the power of the state's policing apparatus to repress and send fear and division through the communities that oppose them. Gobic Taconite, or GTAC, and Chris Klein have millions of dollars in the support of the state to destroy the Pinoki's hills. In a quote from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And hunt saboteurs have faced intimidation from Royal Agricultural College hunters. In this story from Hunt Saboteurs Association on the Earth First Newswire. On Saturday, the 10th of January, hut saboteurs attended a meet of the Royal Agricultural College Beagles, who were meeting at the Holford Arms knockdown Gloucestershire. From previous visits, the hut saboteurs know that the RAC hut hares, which was made illegal in the 2004 Hunting Act. Upon the sab's arrival, they discovered the hut chasing a hare in the fields behind the meet. They quickly stopped and headed back to their meet. The sab's then returned to their vehicles, ready to depart. As they approached their vehicles, they were confronted by a large group of supporters, presumably from the university, some of whom were very obviously intoxicated. In a clear attempt at provocation, one of the young men pulled a fox's brush and a dead rabbit out of his pickup, thrusting it at the sabs. Others were pushing and shoving people around, trying to separate and single out sabs from the rest of the group. Refusing to rise to this, sabs got in their vehicles and, in an attempt to leave, four vehicles driven by hunt supporters then blocked the small lane, preventing them from leaving. One of the hunt sab Land Rovers had its windscreen smashed, and a large group of hunt supporters then started to rock the Land Rover from side to side, chanting, "We are the boys of the RAC," as they did so, with the occupants still inside and fearing for their safety. The dead rabbit was then thrown on the bonnet of the Land Rover, and mud was speared over the driver's side of the windscreen and side windows to obscure their vision. Several attempts were made by these thugs to enter the vehicles as threats of violence were dished out. While this was happening, two whippers-in of the hunt, including Tom Ind, were present in full hunting attire, laughing at the behavior of their peers and egging them on. The saboteurs were eventually managed to escape, but were followed for a considerable distance by five vehicles full of the intoxicated hunt supporters. Lee Moon, spokesperson for the Hunt Saboteurs Association, stated, "We have to ask the Royal Agricultural University if they think this violent and unlawful behavior, as well as clear flouting of the Hunting Act by its students and staff, is acceptable. The RAC are supposed to be a respectable institution, yet their students are acting more like a bunch of football hooligans, drunk driving and causing criminal damage. We would like to hear the RAC officially distance themselves from illegal hunting and this loutish behavior and take disciplinary action against those involved." And a New Jersey man has been sentenced for trafficking in rare narwhal tusks. In this report by Dave Sherwood, with editing by Scott Malone, Bill Trout, and Andrew Hay of World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. A New Jersey man convicted of illegal trafficking the spear-like tusks of the narwhal, a protected species of Arctic whale nicknamed the Unicorn of the Ocean, was sentenced this past Monday to 2 years and 9 months in prison, officials said. Andrew Zaruska, 61, of Union, New Jersey, was found guilty of conspiracy, money laundering, and smuggling by a federal jury in Bangor, Maine last February after a multi-year two-country undercover investigation that spanned from Alaska to New Brunswick, Canada. Zaruskas will also pay a $7,500 fine and face a 3-year supervised release, court officials said. Federal investigators said Zaruskas bought 33 of the illegally imported 5 to 10 foot long spiral tusks from an officer of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, Gregory Logan of New Brunswick, then resold them at flea markets for as much as $70 an inch. Logan, who is awaiting extradition to the United States after conviction of trafficking charges in Canada in 2013, smuggled the hollow tusks across the border in Calais, Maine, then sent them to customers, including Zaruskas, from a FedEx office in Bangor, according to court filings. The narwhal is protected by the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, or CITES, of wild flora and fauna. Zaruskas' attorney, Steve Smith of Bangor, said his clients, who had once tipped U.S. investigators off to a sperm whale tooth smuggler in Nantucket, plan to appeal the decision. Mr. Zaruskas is a sporadically employed New Jersey construction worker who likes to go to flea markets, Smith said. He was never present when a tusk crossed the border, and we think any suggestion that he knew the tusks were illegal is shaky. The narwhal's tusk is a sensitive tooth that projects from the mammal's upper jaw, connecting its brain to the ocean environment. Narwhal tusks, once believed to have medicinal powers, were peddled to nobility in Europe as unicorn horns by Vikings and other traders who for centuries hunted narwhals in northern seas. Today, only the Inuit of northern Canada and Greenland are permitted to hunt narwhals. And ICE is hindering a cleanup of the Yellowstone oil pipeline spill in this story by Zahra Herji, with contributions by Elizabeth Douglas, Inside Climate News. In eastern Montana, an oil spill under the Yellowstone River over the weekend has tainted water supplies in Glendive, a nearby town of about 6,000 people. The river's thick ice cover, which is 2 feet in places, is complicating the cleanup efforts. At around 10 a.m. on Saturday, January 17th, a stretch of the Bridger Pipeline, LLC's popular pipeline, Poplar Pipeline, that crosses the Yellowstone River, cracked for reasons still unknown. Company workers in Wyoming detected a drop in pressure and shut off the pipeline by 11 a.m., but during that time, some 300 to 954 barrels, about 12 to 40,000 gallons of oil, were released. 4 days after the spill, the Poplar Pipeline, which transports crude oil across Montana, is still shut down. A section of the 50-year-old pipeline measures 12 inches in diameter and a half inch thick. According to Bill Salvin, a public relations specialist hired by the pipeline company, the size and type of the rupture is unknown, and it's in a stretch of pipe directly underneath the riverbed. That means that most of the oil likely leaked into the water. The spill site is approximately 7 miles upstream from Glendive, Montana, where the river passes through town. It's frozen over. Councilman Reichert, who can see the river from his house, told Inside Climate News that no oil is visible there. But around 50 miles downstream near the city of Sydney, there's open water and an oily sheen has been detected. Sydney, however, doesn't draw its drinking water from the river. While state and local officials won't say how long they expect the cleanup to last, Glendive Mayor Jerry Jimison predicts it will be a while. Jimison said the river's ice can linger until as late as mid-March. Until all the ice is gone, he said, I don't think the response team is going to have much success in cleaning up. Richard Mylott, Environmental Protection Agency spokesperson, told Inside Climate News in an email, the challenges posed by ice in the river will make collection and recovery more difficult. Earlier this week, Montana Governor Steve Bullock declared a state of emergency in Glendive's county of Dawson and the neighboring county of Richland. Before oil recovery can begin, the strength of the ice needs to be determined. The thicker and cleaner or whiter the ice is, the stronger it is, and the safer it is to walk and work on, said Bradley, who has 23 years of experience in handling oil spills. The thinner and dirtier ice is much more prone to breaking. Once the ice is established as safe to move around on, it's possible to start a process called ice slotting. That involves carving out narrow channels in the ice and scooping up or skimming the oil that's floating near the water's surface. Crews have begun ice slotting operations in the river between the spill site and Glendive, Montana. Reconnaissance crews are working to identify and access pockets of trapped oil beneath the river in the same segment, according to a Tuesday night report by EPA's on-site coordinator Paul Perrenard. In Montana, a boom was set up 40 miles downstream from Glendive in a patch of open water near the town of Crane, but even there, issues have arisen. According to EPA's Perrenard, further ice formation is creating flows of smaller chunks of ice and bergs that are hampering the ability of a boom in the river to prevent further migration of the oil. Councilman Reichert finds the presence of benzene disconcerting. The Federal Centers for Disease Control says the observed level of benzene isn't bad in the short term, but according to the EPA's website, there's no safe level of benzene exposure in drinking water, he said. Residents are instructed not to drink or cook with city water and instead use the 10,000 gallons of water trucked in daily by the company responsible for the spill. The mayor said Bridger has really stepped up to the plate in terms of handling the spill response and the city's needs, but he is wary of how long it will be before the water supply is deemed safe enough to drink. For now, Councilman Reichert joked, I've been drinking beer and I know how to cook with beer. On a more serious note, he added, will this be an ongoing problem? Will it just clear up? I don't know. And Yellowstone bison have been sent to slaughter in this story from the Buffalo Field campaign as found on the Earth First Newswire. An estimated 101 of America's last wild migratory buffalo were crammed into tribal stock trailers at Yellowstone National Park's Stevens Creek Bison Trap this morning. The bison were taken by tribal entities affiliated with the Interagency Bison Management Plan to tribal slaughter facilities. The two tribal affiliates shipping bison to slaughter for the second year in a row are the Confederated Salish and Kootenai Tribes and the federally chartered Intertribal Buffalo Council. It is unthinkable, profoundly incongruent, that Yellowstone National Park and Native Americans would participate in the brutal abuse and slaughter of the only wild population of buffalo remaining in this country, said Buffalo Field Campaign spokeswoman Stephanie Shea. You think to yourself that this can't possibly be happening, but the shocking reality is that those who should be the fiercest champions and strongest allies for the buffalo are instead betraying them by taking the lead in the livestock industry's culture of death. On Tuesday, at least 5 wild buffalo were transferred from the trap to a USDA plant, Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service facility, where they will join other captive wild buffalo being used in a highly controversial experiment with the chemical pesticide Gonacon. An estimated 250 wild bison have been captured inside Yellowstone's trap since last Thursday. The captured number is an estimate based on counts taken at long distance by Buffalo Field Campaign volunteers. Only portions of the trap are visible from a great distance. Yellowstone initiates an extreme public access closure, expanding 7 miles around the Stevens Creek trap, making it nearly impossible for the public to observe government operations. Exact capture and slaughter numbers are unknown because, for the second year in a row, Yellowstone officials refuse to be open with the public about their bison operations, stating they will only give out reports every 2 weeks. Buffalo Field Campaign has requested media tours of the Stevens Creek trap numerous times, but those requests have gone unanswered. I feel really disappointed that the Park Service, because they are working for the wrong team and are hiding from the public, said Maria Farinacci, a volunteer for the Buffalo Field Campaign. Park Service agents work for the park because they want to have a secure life, have a good job, probably to work with wildlife. But these individuals are making the wrong choice, doing this work for the interests of Montana's livestock industry, not for the park or the public, and certainly not for wild buffalo. The public has no voice when the Park Service does that. Even a few miles away from the trap, Buffalo Field Campaign volunteers documenting this morning's operation were uniquely positioned to get some detailed footage and were successful in observing the buffalo as they were loaded into stock trailers this morning, enabling us to get a very close count. Yellowstone can try to hide their shameful crimes, but we are on the ground in the field always watching, said Shea. Often this vigilance really pays off, as it did today, but that doesn't excuse Yellowstone's secrecy. Yellowstone owes it to the public they serve to fully disclose what they are doing, and we will continue to press them to do so. Yellowstone and other IBMP cohorts intend to kill at least 900 of Yellowstone's wild buffalo this year through hunting and slaughter. IBMP affiliates are no longer using the weak excuse of brucellosis to commit unjustifiable actions, but now have shifted their argument to population control. They aim to reduce the most important bison population in the world to a mere 3,000 animals due to the intolerance of Montana's livestock industry, intolerance that is codified in the statute MCA 81-2-120, a law crafted by the livestock industry that needs to be repealed. The 3,000 population cap is an arbitrary number based on livestock industry politics, not on science or carrying capacity. Yellowstone's own bison carrying capacity studies indicates that the park can alone sustain upwards of 6,200 buffalo. Yellowstone buffalo are America's last wild migratory herds and the most important bison population that exists. They are the last to identify as a wildlife species and ecologically extinct throughout their native range. They have been added to the International Union for Conservation of Nature's Red List for being threatened with near extinction, and even Montana designates the species in greatest conservation need, with conditions making bison vulnerable to global extinction. Yellowstone National Park has been entrusted by the American people as stewards of this country's last wild buffalo, said David Martin, coordinator with Buffalo Field Campaign. Stewards are supposed to protect and defend, not abuse and slaughter, so we can no longer trust them to do the right thing. West Yellowstone and Gardner, Montana-based Buffalo Field Campaign is a nonprofit public interest organization founded in 1997 to protect the natural habitat of wild migratory buffalo and native wildlife and stop the slaughter of America's last wild buffalo, advocate for their lasting protection, and work with people of all nations to honor the sacredness of wild bison. You can read more about the Buffalo Field Campaign at their website, www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. And rhinos recovers from poaching attempt and births a warrior in this story from Riot News, as found on the Earth First Newswire. Thandi, the rhinoceros, was left for dead by poachers nearly 3 years ago, meant to be among the 600 rhinos killed in South Africa in 2012. She beat the odds and, after a slow recovery, has given birth to a healthy calf, Game Reserve managers announced recently. The calf's birth is being celebrated as the rhino population is under intense pressure from poaching. Rhinos are an endangered species hunted for their horn as demand rises in some parts of Asia. More than 1,000 rhino were killed last year in South Africa alone, which houses the world's largest remaining rhino population according to government statistics. As soon as the new calf could walk, Fandy led the newborn deeper into a now cordoned-off area of the Kariega Game Reserve in the country's Eastern Cape Province, said Representative Bronwyn de Oliveira. It took Fandy a long time to trust humans again after poachers hacked off her horn and left her to bleed to death along with two male rhinos in March of 2012, said de Oliveira. One of the males died immediately, while the other only survived for several weeks, she said. Fandy was found in a pool of her own blood, she told the Associated Press. Fandy, whose name means to be loved in the Isi-Xhosa language, went through nearly 3 years of recovery, including 4 skin graft procedures, said de Oliveira. Now the mother and calf are doing well, according to the rhino's veterinarian, William Folds, who observed the pair from a short distance, the game reserve said in a statement. The calf has not yet been named, and its sex is still unknown. The reserve is doing everything it can to protect the mother calf and remaining rhinos in the park, de Oliveira said. The Kariega Game Reserve has appointed a rhino protection unit, security workers dedicated to guarding the animal, and each rhino wears a tracking device. The reserve has also removed the animal's horns, a controversial decision because researchers have not yet determined the effects of removal on the rhino. We would prefer them to be alive, however, said de Oliveira. And a new satellite system is set to track illegal pirate fishing in this story reported by Chris Arsenault, editing by Tim Pierce from World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. About 20% of the world's fishing catch is taken illegally by poachers, experts estimate, but a new satellite tracking system launched on Wednesday aims to crack down on the industrial-scale theft known as pirate fishing. Run by the British technology firm Satellite Applications Catapult and backed by the Pew Charitable Trust, the Eyes on the Seas will open a virtual watch room. Computers will be able to watch satellite feeds on the waters around Easter Island, a Chilean territory in the southeastern Pacific Ocean, and the western Pacific Island nation of Palau, which lacks the resources to monitor all the illegal fishing taking place near its waters. The project is now live and capable of monitoring waters across the world's ocean. The technology analyzes numerous sources of live satellite tracking data, enabling monitors to link to information about a ship's country of registration and ownership history to spot suspicious vessels. The system will enable authorities to share information on those vessels operating outside the law, build a comprehensive case against them, track them into port or within reach of enforcement vessels, and take action against them, Joshua Reichert of the Pew Charitable Trust said in a statement. We want to identify the bad actors and hold them accountable, making enforcement easier and more cost-effective. Tommy E. Remengasa Jr., Palau's president, said his country had already been able to identify suspicious vessels in its marine zone with the help of the project's supporters. The watchroom is a digital platform which can be accessed remotely by governments rather than a physical space. The program's backers plan to expand it to other countries over the next 3 years. Illegal fishermen, the value of whose catch is estimated up to $23.5 billion annually, operate with near impunity in some areas where they think themselves safe from tracking, according to Pew Trust. In some regions, as much as 40% of the total catch is thought to be taken unlawfully. Consumers and environmental groups have often had no way of knowing whether the fish they are eating come from illegal operations, but the new satellite program can help change that, said Spain's former environment minister, Cristina Narbona. And we have some time for some biological diversity news tonight. Emergency help is sought to save a Miami beetle from a shopping mall. The Center for Biological Diversity has filed an emergency petition to protect an extremely rare Florida beetle that lives on only one place on Earth, a site in Miami that could soon be occupied instead by a Walmart and a theme park. Miami tiger beetles got their name for their aggressive predatory behavior, strong mandibles, and fast running speed. They were believed extinct until recent surveys found them in Miami-Dade County's beautiful Richmond Pine Rocklands, one of the rarest habitats in the United States. Said the center's Florida director, Jackie Lopez, now the only home of this amazing gem-like creature is threatened with a shopping mall. The Miami-Dade County Commission is preparing to vote on a proposal that would call this rare habitat blighted and a slum, which could grant a tax break to developers. Tell the commissioners the country is watching and won't let them get away with this unethical deal. Help protect the Miami tiger beetle. 226 million acres of protected habitat have been proposed for Alaskan seals. The future of Alaska's ring seals just got brighter. The feds are proposing to protect more than 226 million acres of critical habitat for these ice seals who are being hit hard by global warming. If finalized, the protected area, more than twice the size of California, would be the biggest critical habitat designation in history. Ringed seals were protected under the Endangered Species Act in 2012 as a result of a Center for Biological Diversity petition. As the Arctic warms, the sea ice these seals rely on is breaking up earlier, and snow caves are collapsing, killing their pups. The proposed habitat protections, set to be finalized soon, would target Alaska's Bering, Chukchi, and Beaufort Seas. We're thrilled that ring seals are getting the habitat protections they so desperately need as their sea ice home melts beneath them, said the center's Shea Wolf. Now the Obama administration needs to make these protections count by reducing the greenhouse gas pollution that's rapidly making the Arctic uninhabitable for ringed seals and other ice-dependent animals. And killing contests for coyotes and other fur bearers are banned in California. In a win for some of the more plentiful and humble mammals, California's Fish and Game Commission voted to prohibit hunting contests that target species like coyotes, raccoons, and badgers, classified by the state as non-game mammals or fur bearers that can be killed in any number without limit. The ban on killing contests came after thousands of Californians, including center members and supporters, expressed opposition to these events. The commission's decision to ban these competitions was based in part on its recognition that subjecting these species to contest hunts does not reflect good sportsmanship. The vote didn't ban hunting contests of species that are designated as game animals, however, such as deer and elk. We're grateful that the commissioners responded to the public's call for science-based, ethical, and ecologically sound stewardship of California's wildlife, said the center's Amarok Weiss. Banning contests that reward people, including children, for killing animals is the right thing to do. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is produced every Thursday evening at 9 o'clock right here in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. If you'd like to listen to a rebroadcast of this or previous Earth First Updates, I suggest that you go to radioforall.net. That's radio, the number 4, dot all. The radio number 4all.net, and there you can listen live or download previous Earth First updates. You can also hear an update presented tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM. Or if you're in Moscow, Idaho, you can listen to 90.3 KRFP Radio Free Moscow, 9:30 p.m. on Monday nights. And I'm told that Free Radio Edmonton is broadcasting on YEG Radio at WordPress.com. They have a rebroadcast 2 p.m. on Saturday and 10 a.m. on Sunday Mountain Time. I, unfortunately, have not been able to get that broadcast. Better luck if you can. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. I want to thank you for listening, and do tune in next Thursday evening for another edition of the Earth First Update.